back out here. I don't come here nearly enough, given how nearby I am. And as you see, what I want to tell you about is quantum measurement in the real world. Real world, for me at least, means a laboratory. It's sort of semi-real, but a little more real than our textbooks. And the picture that I want to have in the back of our minds is that quantum measurement is something that people have liked to argue about since the beginning days of quantum mechanics. It's been the big philosophical problem in quantum mechanics, and most people have thought that it was nothing more than that, something that you could ignore and just go ahead and do quantum mechanics if you wanted to. And that's really begun to change in, I don't know, the last 10 or 20 years, in large part due to two things that have happened in parallel. One of them is technological developments that mean that we really have the capability of studying individual quantum systems, manipulating them on the quantum scale in the laboratory now. And the other is fields such as quantum information that have made it important to understand these fundamental questions and made people recognize that they may have practical importance. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some different aspects of where I think quantum measurement is going today, different kinds of quantum measurement out there. But in the back of my mind, even if we start talking about math, I want to have a picture of this guy here, that's Chris Helmerson, staring at a cloud of glowing sodium atoms. When I say quantum measurement, that's what I mean. Some guy staring at something, trying to figure out what it's doing. Everything else is formalism, but at bottom, us looking at something is what a measurement is all about. So before I get into the talk proper, let me also just advertise a conference on quantum information and quantum control. It's going to be in Toronto this August. The abstract deadline has already passed, but you guys are close enough that I hope some of you will just attend anyway. It should be a very interesting meeting covering all aspects of quantum information and control, as well as foundations. And it'll be the chance for us to celebrate the violation of this inequality up here, which most of you should recognize as the 50th anniversary of Bell's inequalities. Okay, so as I said, quantum measurement turns out to be a really rich field. There are many different kinds of quantum measurement, not just what you learned about in your textbook. And if you remember one thing at the end of this talk, I'd like it to be that there are different kinds of quantum measurements, and different ones are actually useful for different applications. And I'm just going to try to give you a flavor of that with a few examples. I'm going to begin with what I think of as just one of the most beautiful examples and a kind of simple one, which is something often referred to as interaction-free measurement, although we'll see that the quotation marks are important, and Hardy's paradox due to Lucien Hardy from here. And I'll go on to talk about one of my obsessions, which is something called weak measurement. But basically, the question that I'm interested in is, can we talk about history? Can I look at a particle and say something about where it must have been before in order to get where it is now? And that's what weak measurement is good for. And after introducing it, I'll try to apply it to a few things, including a sort of resolution of Hardy's paradox and some other quantum mechanical paradoxes, such as what happens in an interferometer when you measure which path the particle goes through, whether or not you can measure trajectories in interferometers, and then the most recent work we've done, which has to do with really directly studying how much you disturb a system when you measure it, and perhaps onto some applications. First, let me give credit where credit is due. A lot of people have passed through our group over the years. At least two of them are in the audience right now. And here is such a complicated color italicization, bold, and underline coding that I no longer remember what any of it meant. But you can imagine that the more red, bold, underlined, and italicized a name is, the more directly relevant to what I think I'm going to tell you about today they are. Anyway, I should say that our optics laboratories were built up by Kevin Resch, who's here now, and Jeff Lundin, and the more recent work on them I'll be telling you about has been led largely by Dylan Mahler and Lee Rosema, but on these particular projects with a lot of help from Rezimir, Sasha Koksis, Yasemin Sudagar, and some parallel work from Xing 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 and Jeff Lundin, as well as Alex Hyatt. We've had a lot of theoretical help from Robin Blum-Kahoot, Howard Wiseman, a few other people, and funding from various nice agencies. All right, so the first thing I want to tell you about is this interaction-free measurement, or as one of the works on it at the time described it, quantum seeing in the dark. I don't really like either of those names. To me, this experiment will always be the Weidman's bomb experiment. That was how it was originally presented. Elitzur and Weidman proposed this interesting protocol. Two Israelis who I guess saw everything in the most militaristic terms possible, but it was really the most dramatic explanation of the paradox. And to me, it's always been very unfortunate that some of the people working on it ended up at Los Alamos National Laboratories, where they actually built bombs and had just grown embarrassed about this fact and needed sort of peaceful applications of everything. So they vanquished the word bomb from their vocabulary for a while, and they won't talk about it this way. But I'm going to give you the unapologetic original version of the paradox. It begins with a problem. So we're going to consider a collection of bombs. And, you know, for the sake of this argument, we'll assume that I'm the good guy, and therefore me having a lot of bombs is a good thing. That's just the working assumption. These bombs are incredibly sensitive bombs. They're equipped with triggers that can be set off by anything, a single gust of wind, or a single air molecule, a single photon, or a single electron, anything is guaranteed to trigger this bomb. Now, obviously, that sounds a little dangerous, so the bombs are shipped with the triggers hermetically sealed in something, and to arm the bomb, you remove that casing. And one day I get a phone call from the manufacturer, who is very apologetic and says that in the last shipment, half of the bombs were defective. In particular, the triggers are defective in such a way that those bombs will never explode. And he says, look, it's entirely our fault, and if you return the defective bombs, we'll replace them free of charge. And I say, well, that's fine, just tell me which ones are defective. And now there's silence on the other end of the line. And he says, well, you know, we figured you were just blowing the things up anyway, so there was no point in engraving serial numbers or anything like that on them. But the ones that don't blow up, those are the defective ones. Now, obviously, I don't want to blow up the good bombs, right? So there's my problem. And I ask him, well, yeah, I don't want to blow them up. So tell me something else that's different about them. Are the working ones lighter or heavier? Or do they have a slightly different moment of inertia? Can I spin them to figure this out? Or if I sniff them, does one smell of acetone or something? And he says, no, it's interesting. The only physical difference between the working bombs and the malfunctioning bombs is that the working bombs will blow up and the others will not. Right, so at this point, it's obvious. There is no way. If that's the only physical difference, then the only way I can tell if it's working is to try to blow it up, in which case I've lost all the bombs. Classically, that's obvious. Classically, it's true. What Elater and Weizmann found is that quantum mechanically, that's not correct. And here's the simplest version of their scheme for telling whether or not a bomb is working. Let's just back up a little. Begin with a simple interferometer. It's called a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, but it's essentially equivalent to the Michelson that might be more familiar. And imagine sending single photons, one by one, into an interferometer like this. Well, obviously, we're going to get interference at this second beam splitter. And if you set it up right, you get constructive interference over here at detector C and destructive at detector D, meaning that every single photon reaches detector C, and detector D is what we call a dark port. It just never fires, okay? But now imagine that we had placed a bomb's trigger in one of these paths. You all remember the Bohr-Einstein debates. Interference is destroyed if we get information about which path it's in. And if I'm blown to smithereens, I consider that pretty good information that the bomb must have been in this path and the photon must have gone that way. And the fact that I'm not blown to smithereens is good information, if this is a working bomb, that the photon must have gone the other way. If it's not a working bomb, I get no information at all. Okay, so the idea here is, if that's a good bomb, it's providing information that will destroy the interference, and otherwise it's not. So what happens? Well, if it is a working bomb, half the time I blow up. Let's just ignore those cases. But the other half of the time, it's the anthropic principle, right? That'll never happen. The other half of the time, the photon goes this way. And if the photon goes this way, it reaches the beam splitter and it can't interfere with anything. So it now has a 50-50 chance of getting to C or to D, which means that one quarter of the time, a photon reaches D. And I say, wait a second. No photons ever reached D when I didn't have a bomb there or if the bomb's detector wasn't working. So every time the photon reaches D, I conclude, oh, that must be a good bomb. And the photon must not have gotten that way because I'm still standing here. So you've gotten information about the fact that this detector works without sending a photon there for it to detect at all. And that's why they call it interaction-free measurement. All right, well, the term interaction-free is a little disturbing. Precisely because we know in quantum mechanics to measure something, you must disturb it. So it's disturbing not to disturb something. And this made a lot of people think, including Elitzur and Weidmann, but also Lucien Hardy. I wanted to put this up first. Many people do like to say that quantum mechanics is like these, you know, Zen koans or questions about the tree falling in a forest when there's no one there. And I think it's interesting to re-question that picture of quantum mechanics and the centrality of the observer. when you think about this experiment, because quantum mechanics in this case is actually telling us that you can tell whether or not the tree would have made a sound if you had chopped it down without chopping it down. So it's almost the opposite of this, you have to be observing it. It's telling you that you can observe things that didn't even occur, things that would have happened. And in some sense, that's because what quantum mechanics is really a theory of is probability amplitudes, all of the different paths that contribute to something, not just one history, one trajectory which did occur. All right, so on to thinking about whether or not you disturb the device. As I said, Lucien was one of the people wondering whether you could really measure whether or not a bomb was functional, or let's say whether or not a bomb was in the interferometer at all without disturbing it. At the very least, you'd think that if you had a bomb that was in a superposition of being in the interferometer and not in the interferometer, by measuring whether it was in the interferometer or not, you should decohere those two possibilities. You must disturb the wave function of the bomb. So Lucien imagined a quantum bomb. The way he did that is he postulated, instead of a photon interferometer, a positron interferometer that would then tell whether or not an electron was in this region W, because we assume that if an electron meets the positron in W, they're guaranteed to annihilate. Let that just be the hypothesis, like this 100% efficient bomb. So now let's prepare an electron in a superposition of being in W or not being in W, and ask ourselves, when D plus fires, this dark port for the positron interferometer, telling me that there should be an electron in W, does that decohere the state of the electron? Well, to answer that question, we should try to study the coherence of this electron wave function, which really just means we should build an interferometer for the electron as well. And now I think we just get distracted by how interesting this picture is, and we forget the original argument, because you immediately notice that the electron is also in an interferometer which can be disturbed by the positron. So on the one hand, if the positron reaches D plus, that tells me something must have disturbed it. There must be an electron in W. But on the other hand, if the electron reaches its dark detector, D minus, something must have disturbed it, which means there must be a positron in W. Now, of course, if there's an electron and a positron in W, what we assumed at the beginning was that they would annihilate, which means that we couldn't have detected them. So it's a very simple argument that shows you that D plus and D minus can never fire at the same time. Except it's equally simple to actually do the quantum mechanics calculation, and it doesn't give that answer. According to quantum mechanics, one time in 16, D plus and D minus will really fire at the same time. So it seems like there's something wrong with this whole idea of interaction-free measurement. I'm going to come back to that. But basically, what we're trying to do is ask, after I see D plus without ever having looked directly at the electron, can I really say something about the state of the electron? Can I do this retrodiction about something I didn't actually directly measure in the past? And that, for me, is the big question these days in quantum measurement, and relevant in quantum information processing, where a lot of protocols rely on post-selection. We might want to ask, what was the computer doing before the post-selection succeeded? So we'd like to figure out, can we talk about what happened before we open that door and look inside the box? So I want to convince you that it's a valid question in quantum mechanics. So I'm going to think of a particular example. This comes from my childhood in New York. I used to hang out on 42nd Street trying to cheat tourists out of their money by putting a $20 bill under one of three boxes and ask them which one it was. You all know the game, right? Except, of course, already being a budding physicist, I like to use quantum money to do this. So instead of putting the money in just one of the boxes, what I'm going to do is put the money in a superposition of box A and box B. I'll put it in A plus B over root 2. Okay, now watch carefully because you might win $20. What I'm going to do is make you one additional promise. I'm going to tell you that I prepared my $20 bill in this superposition, A plus B over root 2, but that later on I'm going to find it. That's the post-selection. I guarantee you that I'm going to find it in a different superposition. I'll look for it in B plus C over root 2, and I'm going to find it there. My question for you is, given those two pieces of information, what can you tell me about where the money actually is between the preparation and the post-selection? No one? So let me rephrase the question. This plus symbol, I know, is very mystifying for people. Replace the plus with the word or. If I tell you that I put the bill in box A or box B, And lo and behold, I found it in box B or box C. Where was it? B. So I always love that one, because what it means is none of you is ready to answer when we do it with the plus sign. Because even though we like to say things like Schrodinger's cat is, you know, alive or dead, or alive and dead, we really don't know if that plus sign is the same thing as the word or. Right? If you knew the plus sign there meant or, you would have known the answer to this right away. And we hesitate because we're not sure about this. It turns out, in a very physical sense, the answer really is B in this sense. In this case. We really can think about this plus sign as being sufficiently like the word or, that if I give you those two pieces of information, you really do know with 100% certainty that the particle was in box B before the two. But we have to figure out what we mean by that. What am I actually trying to predict? What measurement do I have in mind? So here's the scheme. And this is the thing that's often referred to as weak measurement, although I really want to stress this post-selective nature, the conditional nature. So I'm going to call them conditional measurements. I think that's more important. Due to Aharonov, Albert, Weidman, and a bunch of other coworkers. And the idea is the following. Imagine preparing a particle in some state I and being curious about some observable A, but then doing a post-selection, measuring later on that it's in some final state F, and only paying attention to this measurement of A when the post-selection succeeds. Okay, so you might think of something like a particle trying to tunnel through a barrier, and I want to know, what does the particle that gets transmitted through the tunnel barrier do? So I fire in a lot of particles in the same wave function, and only 1 in 100 gets transmitted. But when one gets transmitted, I ask some question about what it was doing. Okay, that's the basic idea. And I ask, well, should the value of A depend on the initial state or the final state, or equally on both, or something else? And their argument was that the Schrodinger equation is time reversible. So it should, of course, depend just as much on F as it does on I. Even though the standard formalism of quantum mechanics says, no, you begin with a state, you propagate forward in time. When a measurement happens, all hell breaks loose, and you do some funny projection and Prade von Neumann and I don't know what else. And then you just start over and go into the future. But the argument is that you don't need to do that. Well, there is one problem, which is if I really measured A, we know, according to Bohr, that that would introduce an uncontrollable, irreversible disturbance on the system. So this argument about reversibility fails once I put that measurement in there. So we need to do this without that irreversibility. And what Aharonov proposed is that if instead of measuring A very well, you only coupled it very weakly to a measuring device, the measuring device wouldn't be able to disturb the system too much. And of course, you wouldn't get very much information either. But their argument was that you'd be able to do this millions and millions of times, figure out what the average value of A was by doing the statistics, but in each individual event, you would have disturbed the system by a vanishingly small amount. So you could still really talk about this transition. You could imagine that you were describing a particle that was already on its way from I to F and wasn't just kicked into state F because of what you did with your measurement apparatus. Okay? So let me try to put that in slightly more rigorous terms. This is how von Neumann talked about doing quantum measurements. This is basically to do a traditional quantum measurement. He reasoned that the first step is always to let your system be coupled to some pointer, some other system that's going to record the value of the observable you're interested in. And that system would also be quantum mechanical, because everything in the world is quantum mechanical. So it will be in some wave function. Here's the wave function of the pointer, pointing basically at zero, but with some uncertainty. And he argued that if you want to measure A, what you'd like to do is move this pointer to a different position proportional to the value of A. And since the pointer momentum, Px, generates translations for the pointer, this turns out to be the Hamiltonian that does that. If you let the system and the pointer interact with some coupling constant times the operator you want to measure times the momentum of the pointer, it will shift the pointer by an amount proportional to A. And of course, if A is uncertain, then depending on the value of A for the system, the pointer gets shifted to a different place. And the system and the pointer end up entangled, which is why either the pointer or the system looked at independently now seems to have been disturbed. The coherence between those different system eigenstates is destroyed when you trace over this pointer, basically. Okay? But that's a consequence of information. It's a consequence of having good information about which of these paths you've taken. I guess I should phrase it one other way, a complementary way is maybe easier to see. In order to resolve these different eigenvalues, I needed to have a very low uncertainty in my pointer position. To have a low uncertainty in my pointer position, I needed to have a big uncertainty in my pointer momentum. But if you look at that Hamiltonian, the pointer momentum is the thing that shows up in the Hamiltonian. So imagine for a second that you're the system. You're the system, you've got this operator A, and the Hamiltonian is grabbing onto that and interacting with it with a very random number. That's why to you, this interaction feels like noise. You have a random Hamiltonian acting on you. On the other hand, if I turn down the resolution of this measurement by making the pointer position very, very poorly defined, I can make the pointer momentum very well defined, in which case this isn't really a random number anymore and it doesn't need to disturb the system. And that was their idea. If instead of that well-localized wave packet, you start the pointer in a very uncertain wave packet, what they showed is that first order, it doesn't become entangled with the system as it did in the strong case. Instead, the system remains essentially undisturbed. And the pointer remains in its original wave function, just shifted by some value proportional to what I'd like to call the value of A. This average shift in the pointer is now what we're going to call the average value of A for that post-selected ensemble. Or they call it the weak value because you extract it by measuring weakly. And what they showed is that in general, it's given by this formula. That, as you see, looks a bit like an expectation value. It's A sandwiched between some states. It looks completely symmetric in F and I to within a complex conjugate. And if F and I are equal, which basically amounts to not bothering to do a post-selection, just taking all of the particles, it reduces exactly to the expectation value for the initial state. So let's think about what those weak values do in cases like Hardy's paradox that we were talking about. We'd like to understand, was the electron really in? Was the positron really in if D plus and D minus fired? Why are weak measurements powerful for this? Well, this goes back to thinking about what the paradox really means. And different people have different readings of the paradox, but I did my best to get Lucien's version and reword it. I hope I haven't done too bad a job on that. Basically, it's known in quantum mechanics that measurements are contextual. In other words, there is no way to model the outcome of quantum mechanical measurements without paying attention to which other measurements are being done at the same time. That's something well known about quantum mechanics. So in this case, we're trying to ask questions about things we haven't directly measured. It turns out, depending on how we set up the experiment, whether we directly measure whether the electron is in that path, or whether instead we put the electron into its own interferometer, we might expect to get different answers to the same value. You can't automatically assume that some unmeasured thing is going to have the same value in all experimental configurations. The interesting thing about weak measurements is that they are not contextual. Weak measurements don't disturb the system. They're just weak values for any given post-selection. And you can combine any set of weak measurements you like and ask how they combine together. So we're going to do that for the case of Hardy's paradox. And we'll begin by just thinking about the probabilities. The electron is either in that interaction region or not. The positron is either in that interaction region or not. And if D plus and D minus fire, what did we originally try to conclude? Well, because D plus fired, we thought that the electron was in, so these two probabilities should add up to one. And because D minus fired, we thought the positron should be in, so these two probabilities should add up to one. And because the particles didn't annihilate, we were convinced that there was a zero here. They weren't both in at the same time. And that was the problem. Except mathematically, it's not so much of a problem at all. You just have to fill in the other squares. And to get this to add up to 1 and this to add up to 1, I have 100% probability of this, but I also have 100% probability of that. And then to make sure that doesn't add up to 200, it turns out I need a minus 100% probability here. Okay, right now that just seems like nonsense. That is the contradiction that I'm led to if I just follow this classical reasoning. But the funny thing that these guys found in this paper is that if you could weakly measure the probabilities for the particles to be in or out from different combinations, this is in fact exactly what you should expect to find. In other words, this 1, 1, and minus 1 would really describe the effect the system would have on a pointer. So to me, that's kind of a striking thing about weak measurements. On the one hand, all right, they're very strange. I don't really understand why I should get a weak value of -1 if I try to measure a probability. But apparently, if you do this post-election, they're saying the pointer really will shift in the opposite direction from what you expect. On the other hand, other than that one annoying axiom about probabilities being positive, these weak values satisfy all of the rules of probability we'd like. They let us go through our classical logic about this experiment and get the right answer and say, yeah, the interaction-free measurement did work. I do know that the positron was in and that the electron was in, and yet I do know that they weren't both in at the same time. Okay? So it takes and it gives away. We actually did this experiment a few years ago. This was Jeff Lundin's PhD thesis. That's just a picture of the optical setup, two interferometers overlaid on top of one another. I won't go into the details. And Kevin and I actually had an idea of how you would measure things like whether one particle was in and the other particle was in. Roughly speaking, the idea is let's have two different pointers, one that I'll call X and one that I'll call Y, and let one of them measure whether or not the positron is in, and a different one measure whether or not the electron is in. And it turns out that by looking at the right correlation between those two pointers, you can extract what we wanted, which is the probability that they were both in. Again, I won't go into the details of that, but I'll show you the experimental results. That, again, is the sort of truth table that we expected theoretically. The world is not ideal, so this is what we found instead. But what you see is that we found a nearly 100% chance of the plus particle being in, a nearly 100% chance of the minus particle being in, and yet a very small chance, about 24%, of them both being in at the same time. Already large enough to mean that we had a greater than 50% chance for the plus to be in and the minus out, and a greater than 50% chance for the minus to be in and the plus to be out, which meant that there did have to be this one negative probability over there, and that really did arise from the measurements. If you look at these pointers and you ask which way they shifted, you actually get a negative value, even for this thing that you are trying to set up to measure a probability. Now, it's natural to ask if I can understand what that negative number means physically, so I thought I would just reproduce a section from the original paper. And most of you don't know me, but those who know me will realize that if I put up equations this long and tables of that many numbers, it means my answer to the question is no, I cannot figure out what's happening physically, or I would have put up a much shorter answer than that. There might still be a way, but we've thought about it for years, and no, all we were able to do is reduce it to these particular combinations of measurable rates and show that it came out negative. If someday someone figures out a simpler story, I would love to tell it. So that was just one example of the kinds of paradoxes that weak measurements let us resolve, but only at the cost of introducing some other strange feature, right? That's usually how it happens in quantum mechanics. I want to go on to another paradox because it introduces a technique that we've been using lately. I want to talk about measuring how big measurement disturbance really is. And this goes back again to the Bohr-Einstein debate, but also to a debate that was big in the pages of Nature in the 1990s, between Marlon Scully and his group and Dan Walls and his group, which at the time had to do with the following question: what is more fundamental, the complementarity principle or the uncertainty principle? And most of you probably aren't familiar with the history of this question. So think about the Bohr-Einstein debate. Think about the kinds of arguments we're used to, like Feynman's argument based on the Heisenberg microscope. If I could measure which slit the particle goes through, then I disturb its momentum, I give it a kick, and that kick washes out the interference pattern. We're all used to that kind of an argument. But that makes it sound like complementarity, this destruction of interference due to which path measurement, is just a consequence of the uncertainty principle. And to Niels Bohr, the complementarity principle is really one of the fundamental features of quantum mechanics. And Scully, Engdahl, and Valtov wanted to take up that viewpoint and argue that we were wrong to think of complementarity as just an aspect of the uncertainty principle, that it was an important principle in its own right. And a lot of people just don't care about this kind of debate, arguing which of two words is more fundamental. It's kind of a strange argument to be having. The other thing that's interesting, though, is I think times have really changed, and by now most of you have probably been educated with this complementarity viewpoint. We think in terms of information now. We think what's important is that I know or could know which path the particle took. And that's what's guaranteed to destroy the information, just as in that interaction free measurement that I showed you before. But at the time, in the 1990s, there were many holdouts who said, no, it's all just another way of saying the uncertainty principle. So Scully, Englert, and Walter made the following proposal. They imagined a two-slit interferometer where the particle going through the slits was going to be an atom. And the atom would travel through one of two micromasers, things that Herbert Walter was famous for at the time and closely related to it Serge Haroche won the last Nobel Prize for. The idea was the following. They knew how to construct these masers in such a way that they could fire an excited atom through the maser and guarantee, or nearly guarantee, that the atom would deposit a microwave photon in that cavity as it went through. So the atom will come out in the ground state, but there'll be a photon, microwave photon, left behind. And if it's left in the upper micromaser, that means the photon's going, sorry, the atom is going through this slit. And if the photon is in the lower micromaser, it means the atom is going through this slit. The interesting thing is that they did calculations to show that depositing that really, really low energy photon in a single mode cavity as you travel through it in more or less a straight line should not disturb your momentum. And yet, of course, the interference should be destroyed if we have the which path information. So they argued that even without disturbing the momentum, you'd be able to destroy interference. Now, that's a little confusing because think carefully about what an interference pattern is. An interference pattern is what happens if particles move very far from the two slits and hit some distant screen, typically in the far field, meaning that what we're measuring actually is the momentum distribution of the particles. So if you destroy the interference pattern, the thing that you have changed is the momentum distribution. Okay? Now, Scully's gang knew that perfectly well. They weren't missing this basic point. So we all know if you destroy interference, that means you're changing the momentum distribution. Their argument was, however, that if you went through one slit or the other, you would not change the momentum. That even though you were changing this interfering momentum distribution, it was not by having each of the micromasers locally kick the particle going through that one. And it's kind of a confusing argument over definitions. But what they proved is that if you just look at the moments of the momentum distribution, all of the moments of the momentum distribution are left unaffected by these micromasers. Meanwhile, Story, Tan, Collett, and Walls came along and they didn't like this point of view, and they proved quite generally that there had to be some momentum kick. In particular, they showed that there had to be at least some finite probability for a momentum kick greater than h bar divided by the separation of the two slits. Now, given that neither of these groups made a simple algebra mistake, it's obvious that they're just using different ideas about what measurements to do or different definitions of what a momentum kick is. There's no other way they could contradict each other. But then which definition should we follow? And a few years later, Howard Wiseman came along and basically argued, why don't we just define operationally what the momentum transfer is and talk about what would happen if you really directly measured the momentum transfer? Now, here's the problem. If I want to measure momentum transfer, what do I need to do? Well, I need to measure the initial momentum just after the slits, but before I do my which path measurement that destroys the interference. And then measure the momentum again after the Welcheweg measurement, the which path measurement, and just look at the difference between the two. That's what we mean by the momentum transfer. But quantum mechanically, I can't measure that initial momentum without disturbing the state. And it turns out that Scully's gang and Walls's gang had been making different assumptions about the initial state. If we actually changed the initial state, one of them would say, oh no, that's not the state we were talking about. The calculation doesn't apply to that situation. We want an undisturbed double slit wave function. So this is where weak measurement comes in. Once more, we want to know about the history of something. And this is what Howard proposed. He said, suppose that after the two slits, I try to measure something about the momentum, but I do it weakly so that it doesn't disturb the particle. I get around this loophole. Then I make my which way measurement. I destroy the interference. And now at some screen, the particle lands somewhere. There's no interference anymore because we've destroyed it with the which way measurement. But any point on the screen here corresponds to some value of the final momentum. And I can ask, is the final value of the momentum any different from what I saw over here? Now, technically, it turns out it was a good idea not to try to measure the momentum here, but to measure a projection operator onto a given value of momentum. In other words, what this device is going to do is weakly measure whether or not my momentum is some specified value. You know, are you 3 grams meters per second or not? Yes or no? And then what we'll do is we'll see if I start getting yeses when this lands at a different momentum, that means there's been a momentum kick, and I can plot out that distribution. So we did that experiment a few years ago. We did it with what we like to call an ensemble of identically prepared single photons. That turns out to be the way you describe a cheap laser if you want to get it into FISREV letters, because otherwise they would have said, what do you mean? That's just a linear optical interferometer. The point is, for experiments like this, there's no interaction between the photons. It actually all is completely equivalent to classical optics. Every photon follows exactly the same story. And all of these complicated elements, I don't think this audience is going to be interested in the optical details, but it's a way of implementing exactly what we talked about, except for this projector onto the momentum. There, what we do is we go into a regime where all the different momentum components have been splayed out in space, and we want to pick just one of them and couple it to some pointer. So what's our pointer going to be? In our case, since we're interested in the motion of the photons transversely, two slits are like this, the interference pattern looks like that, we have an additional degree of freedom. The photon could be pushed up or down, and we can use that degree of freedom as our pointer. And then we'll see when the photon lands on the screen how far up or down has it been pushed. So what we do is we make a narrow sliver of glass and we place it in the pattern, tilted at some angle, so a photon going through it gets deflected very slightly by an amount smaller than the width of the beam, in other words, smaller than the uncertainty of the photon position. And that way, by looking for the vertical deflection of photons that hit our CCD camera, we can tell what fraction of them went through that piece of glass. Okay? But of course, that piece of glass has a finite thickness, so it's not really a delta function. It's some square, some range of momenta that we're sensitive to for a given measurement. So we try to calibrate that without any which path measurement. We just look along our CCD camera. Here's the horizontal axis of our CCD camera. We see a bunch of light. And at each horizontal position, we measure how far up did it get shifted. And this is just a plot of the central vertical position of the photons that hit each horizontal position on the CCD. Now what you see is we put the glass slide in the middle, so there's a little rectangle here in the middle. All the photons that were in the center got shifted up, and all of the others didn't. Okay? You see some additional features, but if you look more closely, you realize those features are just noise. The reason there's noise there is because we actually had an interference pattern. So there are regions here where there are essentially no photons. Now what I'm plotting is where the center of that photon distribution is. It's very difficult to measure where the center of nothing is, so you end up with a lot of noise. Okay, but other than the noise, you see we just have a flat line here. All right, so that was just a calibration. But now we went ahead and we inserted the which path measurement. So the first thing that does is it destroys the interference, and you see we no longer see that periodic noise here. But you also see that even if we place the piece of glass at the center, we no longer just see that broadened delta function. We see a kind of rectangular thing in the middle, but then we see some broad tails here also. And those are not just noise, those are exactly the tails that are predicted by theory. And if we move that glass slide to different positions, well, we always see some feature where the slide is, but we see more and more complicated things that move away from it. So we think of these distributions as telling us the distribution of momentum kicks that were created by introducing that which path measurement. And we can integrate over all of the different final momenta, the distribution of initial momentum given final momentum, to just see one big probability distribution for delta P, for the momentum kick. And this is what we get. There's a big delta function in the middle, and then there's stuff out to the sides. And you see that in keeping with the story Tan, Collin, and Wall's theory, this stuff out to the sides extends beyond these two dashed lines that represent h-bar divided by the slit separation. Okay, so we've confirmed that theory. There is some momentum kick larger than h-bar over A. But the interesting thing is if you calculate the moments of this distribution, at least of the theory one properly apodized, they're all zero. And earlier I tried to make the case that if all the moments of the distribution were unchanged, that meant the distribution was unchanged. Or if all of the moments of this delta k distribution were zero, the delta k distribution was just a delta function. That relied on unspoken assumptions about how well-behaved the function is. And in particular, it would be true for a positive definite probability distribution. But what you see here is we now have a distribution that goes negative, which is strange because I'm calling it a probability distribution, but it's exactly like what happened in the case of Hardy's paradox. If you try to do this probability measurement, this measurement of a projection operator, but you do it in the weak regime with post-selection, and you look at what happens to the pointer, sometimes you find it goes in the wrong direction. The answer just really is negative. And the fascinating thing in this case is it's only because of those negative values that it's possible to satisfy both Scully's theorem and Walz's theorem. It is non-zero outside that region, and yet all of its moments do vanish. So to me, this is particularly remarkable because remember my argument that the contradiction between Scully and Walz was just because they calculated different things. So what happened afterwards? Wiseman came up with a third thing we should measure instead of either of their definitions. And it turns out if you measure his thing, you agree with both of their theorems for their two different definitions. So to me, that's sort of a hint that there's some reason all of these things have features in common. All of these different groups were trying to come up with the right way to define a momentum disturbance. And they came up with slightly different definitions. But my impression is they must have all been getting at some deeper truth. There's some underlying commonality. There's some reason that these different definitions do share these particular features. I don't know exactly what that is. I don't know the end of the story, exactly how we should think about momentum disturbance. But I think these weak measurements have given us a new perspective, operational ways to measure these things and really ask what is the distribution of things like that momentum disturbance along the way. Okay. So there's one more thing I want to talk about. I think if I haven't overstayed my welcome yet, I have a few more minutes. This is on bending the rules. A few of you probably saw this paper about our work a year or so ago. We were always very pleased that anyone reads our papers at all, especially someone in the BBC, although I have to admit we were a little embarrassed when they presented our work by saying that we had bent a rule of quantum mechanics by measuring trajectories of particles in a two-slit interferometer. Actually, Palmer is a very good journalist. The article was extremely well written, but this whole thing about bending the rules embarrassed me because my PhD supervisor, Ray Chow, always used to teach us that you should never bend a rule if instead you can break it. So I don't want to tell you about that experiment at all. I want to tell you about the sequel where we're going to claim that we actually broke Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So just to remind you, again, in the context of the Bohr-Einstein debates, if you measure which slit it goes through, you make some precise measurement of the position, you're guaranteed to disturb the momentum by an amount delta p at least equal to h bar over twice delta x. Okay? Now, I've been reading that and repeating it for many years, and I've always made it a point to tell my students that although the statement is true, that's not how I want them to think about the uncertainty principle, because that's only a limit on how well you can make measurements, which sounds like, kind of interesting that you can't make measurements as good as you could conceive of a measurement being, but it's not as deep a statement as the way we now interpret it, which is the following, that any quantum state in which x has a definite value is guaranteed to intrinsically have an undefinite value for its momentum. Not just that my measurement of position will disturb momentum, but that they couldn't both have had definite values in the first place. So that, I think we all agree, is a much more shocking statement about the world. Except it turns out that the first statement is not just less interesting, it's less interesting and less correct. And correctness being a binary property as far as I'm concerned, that means that it's wrong. The thing that we've been teaching about the uncertainty principle is simply not even somewhat correct. So let me give you an example, not for position and momentum, but for spins, that I think makes it kind of clear what I mean. Here's the equivalent uncertainty relationship for spins. Delta Sx, delta Sy is greater than or equal to the expectation value of Sz upon 2. So suppose I tell you the expectation value of Sz is 1/2. Well, I've actually told you exactly what the state is, right? There's only one eigenstate with Sz equal to 1/2 or bigger. It's just the plus z state. So I've told you what the state of the system is. It's this spin up particle. And now let's ask about the uncertainties in x and y. Well, you know that's an equal superposition of plus x and minus x, or also of plus y and minus y. So delta Sx and delta Sy are both 1/2, and their product is 1/4, which exactly saturates that bound. But that's not what the question was about. The question was about how precisely I could measure Sx and how much it would disturb the particle. So let's ask, using that definition, how precisely can I measure delta Sx? What is the uncertainty of the measurement? Well, that could be zero. I can do a projective measurement of Sx, right, in principle, which means that the precision goes to zero. And we therefore expect it to disturb y a lot. If I measure x, sure, if I measure x, I'll either get plus x or minus x, and y will be completely uncertain. Except, remember, y is bounded, right? Y is either plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. How much can I disturb it? I can knock it from minus 1/2 to plus 1/2, or vice versa, but I can't move it by more than plus or minus 1. So even as I let delta Sx go to zero, delta Sy may get big, but it always remains finite. So this measurement disturbance product goes to zero, even though the right-hand side, the expectation value of Sz, is 1/2. Okay? So a very simple example that I'm not guaranteed to create as much disturbance as you might think if you interpreted this as having to do with disturbances. Okay, so it was about 10 years ago that Ozawa pointed out that you could take this uncertainty principle, which we still believe for variances, right? The proof that you've read in your textbooks doesn't discuss measurement disturbance. It discusses the variances of the operators themselves, and that's a mathematical proof. It's correct. On the other hand, if you just take the same expression and you interpret it as having to do with precision of measurement and disturbance to the conjugate variable, it's just not right. That's not the thing that's proved in the textbooks. And although for a long time we thought it was probably also true, it's not. Ozawa, in fact, proved that you can write the following inequality, which is correct. And you notice it's got this same term on the left, the product of the precision and the disturbance, and the same right-hand side. But there are two additional terms on the left, which are also both positive, which means that it's possible to satisfy this inequality but violate this original Heisenberg inequality. Okay? Now, the question is, how do you measure disturbance due to a measurement? You'd need to know what some variable B was before measuring A, and then check it again after measuring A. But unless you were already in a state of B, when you measured B, you'd be disturbing things at the beginning. So you end up in this sort of infinite loop of every measurement you try to use to test it disturbs the system as well. And of course, the solution, as far as I'm concerned, is to use weak measurement. Turns out that's at least one solution. There was another one proposed by Ozawa himself, carried out 2 years ago by Hasegawa's group in Vienna, where they did something a little more like tomography. They did a whole sequence of other measurements and were able to indirectly extract these combinations. But I'm going to tell you about another proposal of Howard Wiseman's and Austin Lund's, which was to use weak measurement in very much the same sense as I showed you in the previous experiment, to probe B, this disturbed variable, very gently before we do the other measurement, and then compare the post-selected value of B with that weak measurement. So schematically, here's the idea of the measurement. We have some system and some wave function, and we've got some pointer. And after they interact, the pointer has moved, and maybe the system is a little bit disturbed. And we're going to consider measuring some observable A and seeing how much that disturbs B. So here's how we do it. We're going to define the disturbance to B as the RMS difference between the value of B before and after the measurement, which we'll extract by doing a weak measurement of B here that doesn't disturb things much, and then doing a final strong measurement of B over here and just seeing how different those two are, doing statistics on that. And of course, we also need to know the precision of the measurement of A, which we'll define as the RMS difference between the value of A on the system before the measurement, so we use a weak measurement here to do that, and the value of A that's shown on the probe over here. Okay, so now we can directly measure both of these things. And I'll probably gloss over the way it was actually done, but I'll just introduce the basic toolkit. How do we do a variable precision interaction so that we can really probe this inequality? Well, we're going to use a controlled knot. That's a way of getting two bits to interact. If one bit is one, it flips the other one. If the bit is not one, it doesn't flip the other one. Sounds like you've made a pretty good measurement. But it depends. If this is the control bit, the system coming in some superposition of 0 and 1, and I send in a probe bit in either state 0 or state 1, then I get perfect information from whether or not it flips about whether my system was in 0 or 1. On the other hand, what if I send this system in a state like 0 plus 1 over root 2? Sorry, this probe in 0 plus 1 over root 2. Well, 0 plus 1 over root 2 is an eigenstate of not. It's the plus 1 eigenstate of not. It doesn't change at all whether or not it gets flipped. So I get no information whatsoever about this. And it turns out as I continuously tune the state of a probe from 0 to 0 plus 1 over root 2, I continuously change how much information I get about the system. Okay, so we can really do as weak a measurement as we like, and we can measure variable strength measurements. So here's what the whole system is supposed to look like. This Tetris piece in the middle here is a variable strength von Neumann measurement of Z, or S sub Z. That's the variable we're interested in. And what we're going to do is afterwards we'll make a strong measurement of X, and beforehand we can do a weak measurement of either X or Z. So we do a weak measurement of X, compare with the strong one afterwards, and we see how much it was disturbed. Or we do a weak measurement of Z and compare it to the output on this probe, and we see how precise our measurement with that probe was. And X and Z have an uncertainty relation with the expectation value of Y on the other side. So we'll see the largest violation if we choose a state where we have Y equals 1. So we start with a Y equals 1 input. And again, it gets a little more complicated. This is what the schematic ends up actually looking like when you do it with two entangled photons. We use a combination of polarization information and path information to implement these CNOTs. So these polarizing beam splitters here actually act like CNOTs. And we use entanglement between two different photons to basically teleport the information from one line to another so that we can do multiple gates in a row. But I think what's more important right now is the question about how weak is weak enough. Remember, I argued that you couldn't do this until you thought of weak measurement, because your initial check of what's the value of B would then disturb the state. So that was the argument saying you needed weak measurement. But we wanted to know how weak do we make it. If we make it too weak, we won't have any signal at all. So practically, we needed to know, is 0.1 weak enough, or do we need 0.01 or 0.001? And we went through the calculation, and we discovered that our predictions for both the measured precision and the measured disturbance were independent of how weakly we did that. It just didn't matter at all. And then it turns out that was even mentioned in Wiseman's paper, although there was no comment on why it was true. And that seemed to go against our idea that, you know, it had to be weak or we weren't really measuring the right thing. And eventually we came to the following realization. If we did too strong a measurement of A or of B here, we would collapse the state. So if we measure Z or X here, right? If we collapse it into an eigenstate of Z or an eigenstate of X, well, then Y is completely uncertain. And the expectation value of Y goes to 0. So by the time we get to the interaction we're interested in over here, we would have turned the right-hand side of this inequality to 0, meaning that we'd never be able to violate the inequality. It would always be automatically satisfied. So we're in the funny situation that if we don't do a weak enough measurement, we can't actually tell by looking at the left-hand side. We would think we had violated the inequality. But in fact, we would have just reset the right-hand side to 0 and not paid attention to it. So we decided we had to be careful about that, and we measured what exactly happens to the expectation value of Y. As you make your weak measurement stronger and stronger, you see the expectation value of Y drops towards 0. So we picked a point where it hadn't dropped too far, considered that weak enough. And here's what we saw. As a function of the measurement strength, we measure both the disturbance and the precision. So what you see is the stronger the measurement, the lower this number for precision gets, right? That means the more precise the measurement gets, because I measured more strongly. But the higher this number for disturbance gets. That's the trade-off. The more precisely you measure, the more you must disturb the system. But if we multiply the two and compare it to the expectation value of Y over here on the left-hand side, what we find is if we plot Heisenberg's product, it comes below this bound in what should have been the forbidden region. It violates Heisenberg's inequality. If instead we add these other two terms that Ozawa talked about, it ends up well above the bound. In other words, we satisfy Ozawa's new rigorously proven inequality, but we violate Heisenberg's original inequality interpreted for measurement disturbance and precision. So if I have 1 minute left, I'll just say this has all been sort of about metaphysics and about how you can use weak measurement to study interesting paradoxes in quantum mechanics. I think it gives us a new perspective about how to think about what quantum systems are doing. But there is also the possibility that they're useful for something in the real world, in particular for doing precision measurement. And here's one example. Paul Quiot was the first person to push this experimentally. John Howell has kind of picked up where he left off. And he used a weak measurement-based idea with the following argument. Remember, this was that weak value. This, in other words, tells you how big the pointer shift is going to be. And if you look at it, you see that it's got a denominator that depends on the overlap of the initial and final states. In other words, if I do a post-selection that's very unlikely to succeed, I post-select on a state that's nearly orthogonal to my initial state, this denominator gets very small, and the weak value can get very big, which means that the pointer shift can get very big. So one of the arguments the original proponents of weak values had is that if you want to measure some very, very small interaction, maybe it would be interesting to do a post-selection that made this thing very big and kind of amplified up the shift of that pointer. The problem is that suppose this overlap is 0.1. The overlap between the initial and final state is 0.1. So I get a shift that's roughly 10 times bigger than what I would normally expect. On the other hand, that overlap of 0.1 means my post-selection only succeeds one time out of 100, right? 0.1 squared. Now, you all know that if I take 100 times more data, my noise goes down by root n. My noise goes down by a factor of 10. So by giving up a factor of 100 in my data, yeah, I've amplified the signal by a factor of 10, but I've also amplified the noise by a factor of 10. I don't win anything if the noise is purely statistical. And the argument over the last few years has been that there are cases where you're not dominated by noise that's statistical, that you can just average away. You're dominated by some kind of technical noise. You simply cannot measure a distance smaller than 5 microns because the size of the pixels on your camera is 5 microns. So rather than averaging more light, you would prefer to magnify the shift so that it shifts by many pixels. Okay? I don't actually buy the pixel argument, but there are other arguments that I do buy. In this paper in particular, Howell's group wanted to study how well they could measure the deflection, angular deflection of a beam of light. And I'm still just mystified by this number. They claimed that they were able to do it with a resolution on the order of 200 femtoradians. I had to like rack my brains to figure out what does that mean in the real world. As far as I could tell, the answer was the following. If I shoot this laser beam towards the moon, and if my hand is much steadier than it really is, and then I move it by 200 femtoradians, the spot on the moon will move by the thickness of a human hair. That's the resolution they're talking about. And they claim that they were able to get that thanks to weak measurement. So we're looking at some similar ideas now. One of the very small quantities it would be interesting to measure is the effect that a single photon can have in some nonlinear medium, like a collection of atoms, on some other optical beam that I'll call a probe. If we could get a big effect on a probe from a single photon, we'd be able to use this to do all sorts of quantum information, quantum nonlinear optics, and things that a lot of us find very exciting. But so far, except in some cavity QED systems, no one's been able to directly measure this phase shift that you'd get on a probe. So our idea is the following. What if instead I prepare the system in some superposition of going through the interaction region and not, sort of like Lucian's electrons, and then I post-select it on some particular superposition, but with a very unlikely post-selection. Well, what's this probe trying to do? It's trying to interact with a photon if there is a photon here. In other words, it's basically carrying out a measurement of how many photons are in this B path. Well, it turns out that one of the odd predictions of weak measurement is the weak value of that photon number can be much bigger than one, even if I know there's only one photon in the interferometer. So we're trying to set up an interferometer where by doing the right post-selection, we get one photon to affect the probe as strongly as if there had been many photons there. And we'll see whether or not that works. It's still in the construction phases. But for now, let me just leave you with some conclusions. I tried to convince you there are many different ways to measure things quantum mechanically. And I hope you're beginning to get the idea that just trusting projective measurements out of the textbook is not the end of the story. There are different ways you can get information about systems, and they're all interesting. You have to measure their pros and cons for particular applications. And particular post-selected systems exhibit a lot of surprising behaviors which we can probe using weak measurements. And I think it's more or less the only practical way to probe those. And they do, in some sense, resolve certain paradoxes, but they create other problems. And there remains this philosophical question of how you want to interpret them. In particular, all of the claims in Hardy's paradox are borne out by weak measurement, but they become non-contradictory when you accept this extension to negative sort of quasi-probabilities. And finally, although Heisenberg's relation is not true about, is true about variances in states, it is not correct to interpret it as a statement about the smallest disturbance that a measurement can make. Thank you very much for your attention.
So as usual, we like to give students the first chance for questions. So any students that have questions?
Professor Seinberg, which is more fundamental?
I'm not sure I believe in such questions. But I do believe that one should not think of complementarity as merely being a consequence of the uncertainty principle. I think we've learned with this new quantum information perspective that complementarity itself, this view that the information determines whether or not you get interference, is an important aspect of how to.
It seems to me that it's all about information, and it's just the way you set up the situation that neither is more fundamental than the other. It's just a matter of how it's set up. That would be my personal opinion.
That's how I would like to think about it, but I don't want to act as though that's a conclusion you can really prove. I think in all of these cases, if you use the right definitions for your uncertainties and your disturbances, you can always find some uncertainty principle kind of disturbance explaining what was going on with the complementarity principle. But you may need to find a different one in each case, which is one argument for saying that the principle itself was more universal. But I think that's a bit of an interpretational issue. I don't think there's a hard, fast answer to questions like that.
Any more questions from students?
Okay, I love the third point where you said these weak measurements may resolve various paradoxes, but new problems are created. That's a negative probability. Mm-hmm. So my question is, with this negative probability, what exactly is the problem there?
Sorry, what is the problem? Or
you have a negative probability, what does it imply?
What does it imply? Okay. So it's a very good question. And I should be really careful one more time to say that we're not measuring probabilities here in the usual frequentist sense, right? I'm not tossing a lot of coins and asking how many times something occurs. Obviously, I'd never predict a negative number for that. So in some sense, it's similar to the situation that occurs with Wigner functions, where you design something to be a probability distribution. It turns out to be negative in some places, but every measurement you can construct from it turns out to be positive. The only thing we mean by these negative values here is if you build a system that's designed to measure this variable, and you make sure it only interacts weakly so it doesn't disturb the system too much, and then you look at how much it shifts by, it's going to shift in the wrong direction. And if that seems kind of limiting and abstract, the only defense I have for it is to say, in the end, when we talk about measuring things quantum mechanically, that's always what we mean. We always mean you build a measurement system and you ask how it responds. There's no other question we really know how to answer at all. So if you take that same attitude about quantum mechanics and you just say, let me extend it to the case where the meter is interacting weakly with the system, what will happen? You really find this surprising result. For instance, I can try to measure whether or not there's a proton in some region of space. by holding electrons nearby and seeing which electron starts flying towards the proton. If the electron starts flying this way, it means there's probably a proton there. If there's a negative probability, negative weak probability for the proton to be there, what I find is that on average, the electron starts moving in the wrong direction, just as though there was an antiproton there or something. So it's a very operational definition.
So maybe I'll open the floor to questions from other people, but of course students can continue to ask questions. So any more questions?
Just one more thought on what I was saying. It seems to me that there's a parallel and series kind of setup to these experiments, the way they are done, and that with uncertainty you have a sliding scale. But if you're totally certain about one measurement, then you're totally uncertain about the other side of it. Really it's about information. So if you're going to be totally certain about one thing, then you're still stuck with no information about the other side. Whereas in the two-path structure, it's really an action in parallel. Whereas with uncertainty, it's an action more. Maybe in series, something.
Yeah, so I'm not
perhaps
sure
what you've done is combine both of those. You've combined both the parallel side of the quantum.
I don't think we've combined anything. I think you raise an interesting point that there can be a difference between measuring two things in series and measuring them simultaneously. And there's been other work on that. I think the big picture here is that there are a lot of different things people loosely mean by the uncertainty principle, and we've never been careful to distinguish them, because most of us at least had the idea that they were all governed by the same formula anyway. What people have begun to realize now is that these are all different. Asking how well can I measure two things is not necessarily the same as saying how well could they both be defined. It's also not necessarily the same as saying how much do I disturb one if I measure the other. It's also not necessarily the same as saying how well can I measure them if I'm forced to measure them in series. So there's a lot of new literature coming out looking at different uncertainty relations and what the constraints are in these different cases. There's also a lot of work on a more information-based view of uncertainties, as you're suggesting, looking at entropic uncertainty relations. So really looking just at how much uncertainty is in a state in that purely information-based way. But I think the bottom line is just there are different ways to quantify it, there are different things going on, and we don't yet have a completely unified picture of it.
Any further questions?
So just going back to the negative probabilities you're talking about.
Yep.
So I'm not sure if this relates. So it's well known that, so in quantum mechanics, you can't have a hidden variable theory. But if you allow negative probabilities, then you can have a hidden variable theory. Are these the same negative probabilities you're probing with the weak measurements? Or?
Yeah, I've wondered about that. I don't think so, but I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I think that the fact that they're negative is necessary to get around things like the non-contextuality. But
yeah, which is
I haven't thought about applying this directly to Bell's inequalities to see if you can, you know, if that resolves the Bell inequality business. Actually, it might well. It's a provocative question, and I haven't thought about it carefully enough.
Because you were showing you were analyzing the Hardy paradox in that.
Sorry, say it again.
You were analyzing the Hardy paradox, and it's sort of so that's a case where there wouldn't be a joint probability distribution, but
that's right.
You could find negative.
It's another case where the only possible solution to for the probabilities includes these negative numbers, and as you say, the same is true in cases like Bell's inequalities.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I'll have to think about that. I'm leaning towards the idea that you might be exactly right and that this could well be a sort of hidden variable theory, except for the fact that I don't know how to interpret that. So I'm still resistant to taking the negative probabilities too literally, and I guess that's why I haven't thought about it as a hidden variable theory. But mathematically, I think it would have the right properties, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Any more questions? Okay, why don't we thank Ephraim again?
Thank you.